Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to Going Off Track.
Hello.
How are you, Brad?
I'm good. I'm very good. I'm about ready for lunch.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I just had a huge bagel from Kosar's.
Yes, you did.
So I'm not going to be eating for a while.
Mm.
I feel it expanding in my stomach.
You do?
As we speak, yeah.
Those are good bagels.
They're very good bagels.
There used to be a great deli in this neighborhood, a little further east where I used to rehearse, that had really good bagels and really good chicken salad. And that would be my, every day before rehearsal, I'd get everything bagel with chicken salad on it.
Nice.
Really good.
Yeah.
The only thing that's tough is, you know, like if there's too much chicken salad and you bite the bagels are kind of hard, you know? I mean, not hard like in a bad way, but, you know, they're not like soft bread. So they kind of, a lot of times they'd squeeze the chicken salad out.
Gotcha. You got
it. So you might end up with it in your lap.
Yeah.
But delicious. I think I'm only talking about it because I'm hungry.
Yeah.
But there, you know, if you like bagels and you like chicken salad, put them together, babe.
Yeah. Good combo.
Yeah.
Definitely a good combo. I think we can just jump into today's guest, right? Is there anything else on your mind?
Yeah, I mean, actually that place that I used to get those bagels
yeah.
was only about two blocks from where I actually met today's guest.
Really?
Yeah, because I met him, I set up, he was doing, his band was doing like
Should
a
we
bunch
just say who it is? Because I feel like this
don't
is...
let everybody guess.
Okay. Sorry, his band was doing a bunch
his
of
band
rehearsals.
Was doing a bunch of rehearsals in the basement of Bowery Electric, which is a friend of mine's club. And they needed somebody to kind of set up the PA and stuff so they could rehearse with it. And I did. And they were fucking loud as shit. And it like and they drank a lot of vodka during rehearsal. I remember that.
Okay. This all checks out. Today's guest on the podcast. Drum roll. It is Eugene Hutz, singer for Gogo Bordello.
And that is the band that was rehearsing in the basement.
Yes, I can imagine
top
them being
volume.
Loud. They have a brand new record that just came out in August. It is called Seekers and Finders. And they are on the road supporting that. And this was a pretty wild podcast, I would say.
Well, he's a wild guy.
Eugene kind of rolled in, and we had just taped a podcast with Roger Murray, and Roger and Eugene are friends, and they were like, we're kind of on like a time schedule, and like Roger and Eugene were like hanging out and catching up and like taking all these photos together, and like Eugene has like his shirt open, was like smoking cigarettes, and it was like, and I was like trying to like figure it out. And I was like, dude, there's no way I'm interrupting these
yeah.
guys. I'm being like, excuse me, we have to do like, so I like let things play out. It was fine. But it was like a very surreal kind of like group of people all hanging out.
It is totally surreal. I would not have guessed that those two guys knew each other. Although I
yeah.
guess I'm not
yeah.
be surprised.
They seemed like, yeah, they were super psyched. Both of them. So that's what we do here at Going Off Track. We bring people together.
And that happened at Pulse Music, where we record this
yes.
podcast.
It happened at Pulse Music on West 29th Street. Check them out online. If you want to book a session there, I highly recommend it.
Mm.
If you like the way this podcast sounds, you can do a podcast there.
Yeah, you could. Yeah. With Steven.
With Steven.
Stefan.
Stefan Grywalski. but yeah, so yeah, Eugene came by right before he was DJing some party. And he mm-hmm. rolled in with a guitar, no case.
That
like,
was weird.
He's just a really, he is like what, like, you listen to this interview, like, that's who this dude is. Like, he really knows who he is. He's a really unique guy. And I think that's why he's been so successful, is like, he's really been able to tap into something that, that kind of draws people to him, like whether it's Madonna or whoever, or and he has some crazy stories. You know, he's recorded with Steve Albini, Rick Rubin, both his musical and his whole spiritual side. I don't know. He's a cool guy. I had never met him before.
Right.
But Benny had known him because I believe they did some shows with Gaslight.
Yeah.
So it was cool. Benny was there and they got to catch up. And yeah, this was just a super fun time. So enough talking about it. Let's get into it. This Going Off Track episode with Eugene Hutz.
It's Going Off Track!
We rolling? Nice.
We're rolling.
All right. Eugene, what's up?
Staying strong, man. You know?
Yeah.
Hustling the streets.
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing.
Obviously, I know you've lived in New York a long time. Are you still based here, or you move around a lot, or?
I just rebased here. I was in Brazil for almost 7 years beforehand, and just decided to move back to the city that gave me everything.
Where were you living in Brazil?
Rio de Janeiro.
Oh, it's quite a town.
Yeah, it's a magical place. I don't know how to explain it. It's just kind of has everything that, you know, every other town doesn't have.
And then some.
Yeah, I mean, they call it swinging London. Then you go to London, it's like, what? It's like this incredibly non-swinging place. You know? And you go to Rio de Janeiro, it's like, oh, that's pretty swinging.
Yeah. Yeah.
What lured you there?
Well, perhaps I wasn't. It will sound banal, but it was, of course, a woman. Oh. You know, that's how it starts. But to make it less banal, even after we broke up, I continued living there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Were you working on a lot of music stuff down there? I mean, was there, like, did you have a studio down there?
Yes. It ended up being pretty much like a full-on fort of creativity for me in a lot of ways. I quickly met some really great people, and we, at its final stages, we almost had this kind of a cabin running where everybody who was coming to play Rock in Rio from our friends, we would make a track with them, kind of like the guests
of
Rio de Janeiro Hoots cabin recording, you know. So that was a lot of fun. Just, you know, everybody who comes to Rio wants to make at least a song there, you know, and you catch them in a different mood. You know, the language is different, the lifestyle is completely different, and people did kind of musically more adventurous things, I thought. You know? So I liked that whole thing. Plus, it was really not... it kind of had like a real more feeling of collaboration that way, as opposed to all these kind of like co-branding collaborations where nobody fucking meets each other, you know, just like send the track over the fucking internet and featuring this and featuring that. Like, I'm like that kind of thing is not my thing, really.
Yeah. I couldn't see you being that into that.
You know, like one of the really good ones that was Goran Bregovic is... It's a European composer and very well known for his soundtracks to a lot of great films. And he came down and we spent nearly 2 weeks together, you know, just kind of having a different kind of flow of collaboration, you know. There is local flavor, you know, there's ocean, there is... you know, in Brazil, it's pretty mind-blowing. So anybody who enters it just gets immediately their mind blown. Yeah. And then they're just transformed into somebody who is capable of different things, of new things, you know. So it was kind of like that. You know, I really enjoyed it.
Nice. I always think about you, associate you with Steven.
Oh, yeah. I think I know where you're going with this.
Well, because when I worked at Fuse with Steven, I remember he had to go interview Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, how'd the interview go? He's like, it's good. I named up Eugene and she got super excited. And I was like, wow, that's like a big move.
She was ruthless to every other journalist there. And I'm not a journalist. And so we went to sit down and talk. And I said, hey, by the way, we briefly spoke a long time ago at South by Southwest,
mm-hmm.
like in a parking lot. We talked for a little bit. And so good to see you. And then I did this Madonna interview. And at the beginning, I was like, hey, I just met Eugene for the first time. She's like, oh, my gosh, I loved Eugene. Can we just talk about him? And I went, yes. And so the first half of this interview, we ended up recutting and putting on the show Jonah and I worked with, which was like, oh, by the way, here's Madonna talking about the next video you're going to see, which is Gogo Bordello video. And then I had the best time with Madonna, and I think Elvis Duran came up next, who's like the number one DJ in the United States, and she destroyed him. Like, you listen to it, she just ripped him to shreds, and I walked out going, I had a really nice time with her. She was right. Delightful. So, hey, thanks.
Well, yes, she also came down to Rio twice, I think, mm-hmm. in the time when I was there. Once with a tour and once with a certain like a favela social kind of support project. So, you know, I took her to the places that were kind of obscure, you know, that her security didn't want her to go.
Oh, wow. What kind of crew does she roll around? Like when she goes to Brazil and she goes to like hang out with someone, like what kind of posse is she coming with?
Well, there's... I think it's pretty much her usual posse, but you know, it's Brazil, so.
I'm afraid I don't know what her usual posse consists of.
Well,
you're going to have to illuminate for us.
Yeah, there's friends and there's a, you know, there's a, I mean, it's a bubble of people,
yeah.
You know, but in Brazil, there's more security, of course.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it had to be actually, it had to be that way.
Sure.
You know, because... If you go to Lapa in Rio de Janeiro late at night, it's everybody's out there, you know, from São Jorge to you know, to all the drug dealers and psychopaths and tourists and soccer players and people who just you know have a very dubious kind of agenda. Mm-hmm. You know, some good rappers, some everyone is out there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really kind of a that kind of place where you can breathe in real wide and as they say, yeah. I remember first time asking somebody, well, is that a really safe place? And they said, well, if you're lucky enough.
I remember actually we were talking at a festival once a few years back and we were talking about this specific thing and about going there and this and that. And you were like, I'm like, so like if I was just coming to travel, like would I be okay? And I always remember this. He's like, yeah. Yeah. With like a little skepticism. And then it's like, but you know, maybe go somewhere at about 6 o'clock and don't bring your laptop.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, okay. I get it. All right. I'll avoid the Valhalla of decadence, but I'll come out during the day.
How long did it take you to be able to like navigate Brazil and feel part of it?
Well, I mean, I was pretty fanatical about it. So I'd say I got on with the program pretty fast. And, you know, I learned with a corner of my eye to kind of oversee the situation and who's around. And, you know, I guess it kind of becomes your second nature pretty fast. It's also not so dangerous as they paint it. I mean, you know how it is. Devil is not so scary as they paint it, is the saying. And it's really quite far from being any kind of devil. It's just a really amazing place, and it's loose on all fronts, you know. So just like, as long as you're not being like a total moron, you know, then you should be pretty okay, you know.
So, for Seekers and Finders, a new record, did you record it down there? You recorded it up here?
No, we started recording in Washington, D.C., and it started kind of seamless. we just, I always wanted to record in the studio where Fugazi did all their records.
Did you go to Inner Ear?
Yes.
Oh, shit.
So we started in Inner Ear with Don's the entire. Yeah. And, you know, and Ian stopped by and sometimes, you know, check out what's happening. And since there was always this kind of a tender in my perception, connection between Fugazi and Gogol Bordello. Chiefly it's because my head was completely blown off my shoulders when I came from Ukraine. I mean, and I was very much my whole like punk rock taste was formed there. So it was European music for the most part, like Joy Division and Sturzen und Neubauten and Nick Cave. So it's Australian, but it's European. Mm. It wasn't that context. So when I came here, I was a kind of a snob, you know. I mean, you know, I was like, I'm a European snob, you know, as far as music goes. Like, and you know, people were trying to show me like kind of Black Flag, and I was like, it's like this is kind of like, you know, let's get something more surprising in there. And then somebody showed me Fugazi, and I was like, wow, like what's that? It was just fucking amazing. It was like Gang of Four and Sonic Youth and Joy Division and all those things that I loved all together and just kind of exploding in this shirtless way, you know, like right. With a touch of this athletic kind of a skateboard vibe to it, like was not my vibe really. And but then I kind of got through Fugazi, I kind of got into a lot of other music, into Bad Brands and so on, you know. So I always wanted to and then eventually, seriously, like one our first tour when we were out touring, I've met Brandon from Fugazi at Black Cat. And then next show we're playing in DC, Guy turned up, and then you know, just like I end up meeting all of them, and they were like just really kind of chiming in with what we're doing. So I was always, you know, very excited about that. So I was like, let's go and do this recording where it's kind of has the right vibe, you know.
Cool.
Where the vibe is not random, but like kind of crystallized. You know?
Is it the same kind of as it's always been over there, pretty much?
Yeah. All those records are stapled to the walls there, and you know, and the Fix bar, and you know, and the whole thing that, and Brandon's bell is there, I think.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, in fact, we just recorded the song with Brandon over at the Sirius FM.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a surprise song for a certain project, but I was pretty psyched to record with him. You know?
Yeah, that's amazing. Cool. You've recorded also with like Steve Albini, mm-hmm. Rick Rubin. I mean, you've recorded with some really amazing producers. I mean, what is every experience different, or do you go to them being like, I think this would be great for this producer?
Well, some of them fall in a place, and some of them, we directly went for that particular sound that we were just kind of looking to join forces with was only with Steve Albini. It was like, let's go and get that kind of like a, those kind of drums and that kind of beef, you know. And so we directly went for contact there. Everything else was really, at the very beginning, it was Jim Sklavounos from, you know, who's a veteran of New York scene, you know, played in Teenage Jesus and the Jerks and the Sonic Youth and the Cramps and now in the Cave and the Bad Seeds. So he produced our first album, which was of like tremendous importance to me. You know, I was literally, I was like, wow, well, I guess I didn't fall off too far from the tree, you know? You know, just like second week in New York, going in a bar, in a bar 16 where this kind of underground party was taking place. And I met Jim, and he came to a couple of our shows very early on. And then he helped us to record his first record, kind of really in his studio, put it together. So I thought I was like off to a good start, you know. So everyone, then Victor Van Vugt, who also, you know, worked with PJ Harvey and the Bad Seeds. He did Super Toronto with us, that record. So that was also very much like, there's a lot of shared taste in that, you know, in that particular bubble of music. Rick Rubin was something that just kind of fell from the sky, really. And I guess Tom Morello told him about us. He kind of picked him up on his way. Tom picked Rick up on his way to our show. He's like, you got to go and see this band. And that's how I ended up meeting Rick. So that resulted into a record. And then Andrew Sheps was Rick's right-hand man on many, many records. So he did the record afterwards.
Is it working with Rick, like, after all these years, how directly, like, hands-on is Rick with, like, actually engineering and tracking and things like that? Is he there for all of it?
Well, I know where you're heading with that, because a lot of people did not get a lot of his studio time, you know, and that's kind of what I was kind of warned about, that it's going to be like right. This kind of like a concept, and we'll sort out the songs, and then just kind of, then we're kind of, we'll go and work with his team.
Right.
But I have to say that record we did with Rick, I mean, he was in the studio 5 days a week with us.
Cool.
And, I mean, we were incredibly pleased with all of that, because there is a lot to gain.
Sure.
In not only musically, but literary as well. I mean, people oftentimes, you know, talk about Rick's production values and this kind of like a monumental minimalism that he kind of brings in. But I think he's actually just as equal of an influence. Is he's very well, he's a very strong literary person, you know, so balancing out the words and kind of helping them to fall in the right place. We spent a lot of time kind of like, I think I kind of went a little bit notch up there for sure through work with him on that level.
Oh, really? Yeah. Too far, you think?
Huh?
Like went too far?
Too far? I don't know if it's too far. It just went somewhere else.
Right. You know?
I mean, but it's also a very like a, I'm giving you like a kind of super insight.
Right.
I didn't see it, for example, in a reviews or anything like that.
Right, right.
It's just kind of what I think.
Sure. That
it was helpful to make transition from to the well-established axiom of less is more.
Right, right.
Because I was maybe only for time being. Because I was always pretty much convinced that more is more. You can tell it from our instrumentation. And I'm still a lot of times think that more is more.
Yeah.
You know? I'm just kind of baroque that way, you know?
Yeah, sure. Well, maybe he gave you just a hint of space that stuck.
Yeah, it's okay to have some things be that way and others not.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty cool. Man.
So I enjoyed going to that territory, you know.
Definitely. I, you know, obviously Gogo Bordello, it's kind of described a lot as gypsy punk. Do you like that term? Do you not like it?
Well, I made it up.
You made it up?
So I mean, it's like not they are just simply using a title of our album, with Steve Albini, to describe it, because when we appeared in a musical sense, like, as I'm saying, in my perception, no wonder that, like, we work with, say, Jim Sklavounos and Victor Van Vugt, because it was sort of in that land of character-driven music that's, like, kind of coming from that kind of strong front man, and you know, and everyone in the band is also strong character,
right? Sure,
kind of land, you know. But it was not so obvious to other people, maybe. And so the reviews that I was reading at the time, I just could see that all the journalists, they were completely unequipped to say anything about our music. Because I have no idea where to put it. And in a way, I kind of had to give them a helping hand. Because I didn't want it to be described in some kind of strange and kind of unappealing ways or something like that. Like as some kind of a klezmer dub, you know, some flamenco freakaholic
world
jazz,
music.
You know. You know, it just was because it's not what it is. It's really essentially rock and roll music, just from our point of view,
right?
Yeah. You know.
Oh, it's interesting that, you know, someone from the States would have no reference to it or very little reference to it.
Very little reference.
Really went to look for it. So I can see.
I mean, actually, in the States, yes. But for example, like people who were living in New York who were from Germany or France or Italy who came to our shows, they were like, man, that sounds like gypsy music. They just knew it right away. You know, it's kind of like it's got that like, it's got that A minor tragedy comedy to it, you know, and this kind of persevering melancholy. And I was like, yeah, I mean, it's, in Europe, it's a lot more understandable.
Sure.
You know, so I just kind of used the magic of idiomatic translation.
See, I first heard about you guys through... Well, merch. I was at a Warped Tour and you played like a one-off. I think it might have been in Ventura. But it was, I just saw people just wearing sweatshirts that said Gogo Bordello. And I was like, this is the best damn merch. What? Where the hell is this band? And then someone said, oh, they're phenomenal live. They're amazing live. They had no idea the sound. Knew nothing about it. And I was like, well, I'll go check them out. And floored by your performance.
Oh, thank you.
Because it's Warped Tour. So depending on the time slot, it's going to be, you know, 100 people or less, you know, and it was, you know, you did the job a band's supposed to do, you know, play to 10 people the way if it's a stadium. And there was plenty more than that to see you guys because word was out. But I was just knocked out by the show.
That was exceptionally good Warped Tour. Tim Armstrong was there with the Transplants. I think even Public Enemy was there. We didn't cross paths with them. They like, we only did like 2 weeks. But there was a lot of... a really cool vibe for that time. So yeah, I mean, we had to get to know our American listener, you know, and get into the Midwest one way or another.
You know? was that I mean, how did that go in the Midwest with your band?
Surprisingly okay.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it was kind of a beginning of that kind of experience we have with people where, I mean, I guess it was kind of a beginning of our grassroots kind of a following, you know, because a lot of bands, let's say, there's kind of route of touring and the bands just kind of go and they don't obscure from it too far. But those places were kind of obscure, you know. And as a consequence of that, going to these places that are more obscure, I think we had pretty massive fan base all over the place, you know. So it doesn't have to be like a inner city on a Friday night for a place to be sold out. It can be quite obscure on Monday or Tuesday night. And it'll be still some thousands of people there, you know. So that's kind of cool.
I think people undervalue that with touring. You know, they keep grinding in these A markets, and it's like until you crack Chicago, you haven't cracked this, when you could have played 4 or 5 shows in a city an hour south of Chicago, and pretty much like everyone in that town is yours now, you know? And like, and people forget for some reason because of what you said. And I think it's getting harder and harder with, like, you know, Live Nation and House of Blues literally like fixing tours and controlling tours inside of their umbrella, and less it's harder to get out to these places in these different cities. And I wish bands kind of addressed in their model more than they do now, you know? And obviously it worked for you guys.
Yeah, I mean, it is an effort.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why a lot of musicians hate touring. You know,
don't like effort.
it can get, if you are in a, you know, I think that we kind of figured out our little key to it, which is essentially really in the performance itself, which is so cathartic and kind of, it's just the biggest payoff really for all of it is really that experience of practically teleporting yourself pretty far the fuck out.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about that, actually. You know? I heard you talk about that with your shows, how it's like tries to harvest this almost transcendental experience, like while you're there, not only for you, but for the crowd. And like, so when you're on stage almost trying, is it like creating an illusion? Or is it just being so true to yourselves that it's that unique that it takes things out of it? It's almost like in order to achieve transcendence, how much of it is performance art? How much of it is music? How much of it is showmanship? Like what's the cocktail there?
Wow. Well, this is like, the thing is that it can start from any given point. It can start from your own accessing your own traumas and overcoming them. It can start from your own catharsis. It can come from getting into a character and still activating just as much of energy out of character. So in my personal like world, all those elements are present, you know, and you can dig into your own performance from very many different sides. You know, it can start as bravado and deteriorate into existential squeal, existential rage, or it can start and the other way around. You know, it's not really important. I think what's important is that... I think what's important is achieving that frequency and altering the vibration and being able to lead people onto that with you, so it becomes like a shared experience,
right?
And a shared experience that's very tangible. Sure. So to the point where just about anything that you're doing seems to be appropriate. You know, and just any of their reactions seem to be also quite appropriate,
right?
And nothing like that can be found on a street, you know. And also it can be quite traumatic if it's just like in a daily life, because the kind of a thing that surrounds it all in this protective bubble is actual vibration of music. So many times I found myself like I'd watch some kind of a clip or a video from a show, and I feel like I'm frightened to watch what I'm going to do. But there's zero fear at the moment.
Right.
You know, and I think there is something, the air kind of around you just has a different quality. Somehow it supports you. And this kind of collective vibration also supports you. You know, I mean, just like some of the diving and all that kind of stuff is kind of, you know, can be pretty detrimental in daily life.
Right.
Now, but even interaction with people, I mean, you don't really see like, you know, the eyes when eyes are sparkling and thousands of them. Is something else is going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you don't really see people reaching out to each other with that type of intensity and throwing their chakra energies at you.
It's true.
And that kind of exchange and vice versa. Yeah. You don't see it in the real life almost anywhere.
Right.
I mean, nowhere. Maybe in Amazon where people are doing ayahuasca or, you know, and or other rituals of that type are similar. But in our society, I think this is like the closest it gets to it, probably.
Hmm.
You know,
a truly shared experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's of course other things that, like sports, but it's just a different thing. I mean,
sex.
I don't relate to that. Well, that, but this, you know, look at the mass of people you're experiencing here. It's just much
you've
horsepower.
Never
here.
Had sex with 1,000 people, Eugene? You should try it. It's incredible.
Yeah. I think he's saying that he has.
Well, essentially, in a way.
Essentially, it is, of course, in that land, you know, but
of
energy. I mean, it's Dionysian.
Right.
Yeah.
It's probably the closest. We're basically talking about Dionysian experience, you know, and how far can that stretch, really? Well, it can.
But it's important to talk about, especially now. I mean, I think so much of the validation of musicians is based on either money. Or your personal validation, like how many people are enjoying your product or enjoying what you put out there. And like, if more people could sort of, it's something that's taken me a while to wrap my head around and I'm still not sure what to do with it. But the idea that like a positive show and a positive experience emanates beyond that show, you know, like, do you truly believe like, this is happening, like...
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... We're living in a particularly sad... sad kind of a... cut of time as far as that goes.
Sure.
It's probably gonna... It's gonna have to bounce back to... appreciating the actual source and the origin of what people are enjoying.
Hope so.
You know, it has to. I mean, it can't go on like this for much longer.
That's so funny you say that, because I have, going back to Fugazi, I grew up down there, and one of my good friends, good friends with Ian, we have a lot of mutual friend stuff, and he said that around 9/11, Ian MacKay was like, I can't watch the news anymore. I gotta start listening to music and going back into more music and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's exactly what you're saying. You know, have to pull yourself away from it and...
Well, I think it's that thing you were bringing up is relevant to, like, you know, sometimes, you know, you've heard of that kind of, what is the name of that scientific experiment where they will have, like, you know, a couple hundred people meditating in a city so in order to bring down the crime level.
Oh.
Like that type of thing, you know, and how it actually brings the crime level down because the vibration raises.
And you can also do that by putting in blue light bulbs.
That, and there's many other things, but that's like pretty pretty effective, you know. Mm. And I think art and music is in the same zone with that. It's, you know, just because, like, you know, Tinder sticks are not playing Madison Square Garden, it doesn't mean that their vibe is not going into our world.
Right.
You know, they're incredibly tender and beautiful music is still having that effect, you know.
And is it even possible at that point, like, in which, at what point is it too difficult an experience to curate with too many people, you know? Like, can that experience come out of a stadium show, like when someone is literally you know, 500 yards away from the source of the...
that's a whole another conversation for sure. But I think as long as we're human species that are designed in such a way, approximately like us, that, you know, that have a uniqueness. I mean, every psyche is unique. And therefore, to celebrate your own psyche and soul, you have to celebrate the idea that there has to be unique other psyches.
Right.
So that's sort of, you know, you can't really, therefore, probably live on a cookie cutter type of art and just this conveyor made you know, phenomena kind of music.
It's true.
What do you think would happen if Donald Trump did psychedelics? Do you think that would, like, change a worldview? Do you think, like, those kinds of people would be opened up to new possibilities? Or do you think some people just...
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, you should probably ask, like, Graham... what is his name?
Oh, Hancock?
Graham Hancock, yeah. Yeah. And David Wilcock.
Yeah.
They're pretty good at that type
of
jazz.
They're good. Yeah.
I'm a massive fan of both, you know. But,
yeah.
But especially of David, probably.
Yeah.
More so. I mean, it's love one. We are all one psyche. So there is no really any kind of separation.
Yeah. I guess, you know, it's hard to feel that connectedness sometimes. I mean,
it's hard. It's very hard, but it's there.
Well, it's funny. What you say is almost part of the intrinsic problem in, like, a Donald Trump is, you said you have to recognize the fact that each psyche is unique and each psyche deserves its own space and its own joy. And people like Donald Trump and some of his friends, they do truly believe that they are unique species.
Oh.
To Earth. They actually believe that they are physiologically better equipped to handle our society.
Absolutely.
Oh, they're into eugenics, and he's a narcissist, and they have the, what's the thing in religion, the prosperity? I look at Brad.
Oh, right, the Joel Osteen thing?
Yeah, like you'll
God
be rich.
Wants me to be
yeah,
rich
because God wants me to be rich.
Right.
It seems antithetical to the idea, to the guy they're talking about. But anyway.
What are they going to do with all the Jewish gold, man? They got to put it somewhere.
They built Stephen. The Vatican with it.
Jesus Christ. Can't yeah. just all live in Switzerland. It's got to go to work.
They can live in Switzerland.
That went dark.
There's Antarctica.
Yeah, there's beautiful. Antarctica.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
I was curious,
down there.
You know, you spent 7 years outside of the country and came back, which have you seen, like, a tangible change from the time you left to the time you've been back? Literally, I mean, you left, like, in the middle of an Obama administration.
Yeah.
And where things felt, I mean, at least to me, felt different.
Yeah.
To now, like, did you see from 7 years and that time lapse, like, a tangible change, or it seemed kind of the same to you?
I mean, the thing is that I think I'm kind of just, maybe because I have a thicker skin for it, because, you know, I was born and raised in the Soviet Union, so I'm not so prone to, like, react right away.
Sure.
I mean, I react in a different way. I mean, I was reading this biography of, just something came to my attention, of this Swedish minister who was, like, heavily involved with in Swedish missions into Africa and Latin America during World War II, and was, like, on all these affairs in World War II, right?
Mm.
And his father was, like, prime minister of Sweden. It's a long Scandinavian name. I couldn't memorize it. But what struck me is that in his autobiography, there was nothing about World War II. Huh. Not even one single mention. Or about any of these other, that his father was involved with this thing. And I was like, it was all about his internal affairs.
Huh.
It was all about his introspection and time, that how he felt at the time and what he was writing. And so, you see what I'm saying? That is just a completely different way. I felt like there's some affinity I found in that.
Huh.
It's not that he was not involved. I mean, he was there.
Yeah, yeah.
He was doing all that. It's just when it came time to write autobiography, he, like,
deemed it unimportant.
He was talking about completely something else.
Yeah.
And something about it I found, like, kind of relevant for myself, you know? I just didn't feel like it's so necessary, like, to get involved with every panic on every corner.
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's really not... Maybe that's just kind of adds to a general frustration and fuego, you know?
Sure.
Maybe that's just not really a role of an artist necessarily, to react as a politician would.
Yeah.
Or a social activist would. Maybe the role of an artist, actually not maybe, I'm quite certain, it's about warming up the perception of, warming up the heart, and kind of coming from intuition point of view.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a different facility altogether.
I agree with that. I'm getting pretty sick on Twitter of my favorite artists and comedians not talking about music or comedy anymore.
What's interesting, I just read this Taylor Swift review where the reviewer was mad that she didn't talk about politics more.
Really?
Yeah, because she's like, she's this big platform, and it's sort of like, I just, people want to project what they believe onto other
right.
stuff.
Yeah,
too.
Of course.
Yeah,
I of saw course. And it's just such a low denominator to latch on to, you know?
It is. Yeah. Yeah, I had heard
it's so
someone,
comfortable, you know? Oh, you know, those guys are left and those guys are right. And,
right.
You know, it's like, are they? You know,
and you're right. And the place as a musician is maybe in neither. I mean, there are certain people who are so involved. Like, yeah, I want to listen to Tom Morello talk about politics. Sure. You know what I mean? I'll listen to, you know, certain people. But when, like, the singer of a pop punk band is giving me like a 139 character, you know, really strong take on like the Afghani war or something, I'm like, shut the fuck up, man. like I don't believe you know that much. I don't believe that you even have the capability
that's the thing. A lot
to intellectualize
of it, is, that's
it
the
in
thing.
This
a lot
capacity.
Of it is just really ill-informed,
exactly,
you know, to and kind of like to rap on those topics, you got to do your homework,
right?
And I have not done my homework,
right?
You know, I'm just kind of like, I'm not that guy. I'm like, I'm this guy.
You've done your homework and other things.
Have you, do you enjoy the acting stuff too? Is that something, do you still do that a lot, or is that whatever comes up?
It's kind of like whatever comes up.
Yeah.
And I really ever thought, the thing is that I thought that I can do that in my sleep. Like, everybody was, in my family, was always just kind of thinking that I'm like doomed to be an actor. And so when several of these things happened, you know, I thought, oh, well, there I come, you know, I mean, just like, you know, they're just like they all said, you know, but do I want to be in the front of camera kind of saying lines? Not really. I have a directorial kind of mind. So I would see myself more interested in, like, if you're asking, am I interested in that? Like, I'd be more interested in directing films, you know, than acting. But if if something great and kind of that's gonna steer me up in a certain way comes up, yeah, I'll be a game. You know, I'm not opposed to it, but I don't really like the lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you got to wake up at 5 in the morning. I mean, come on, yo. And, you know, they work very long hours. Most of it is waiting, and waiting and waiting and waiting. And it's so tedious.
Yeah.
Stand here. Say it again. Now we're going to move the camera. Say it again. Now we're going to move the light. Say it again.
And, you know, and plus, I haven't even had, like, the best experience. I've had the best experience because they loved me. So I got away with everything. Like, I never got any sleep. I didn't know my lines. And, you know, I was not there 5 in the morning. You know? Yeah. I, you know, and I still thought it was pretty tedious. So imagine if you're doing it, like, on a grid and with the crew and being on best behavior. Man, no wonder they get paid such a big bucks.
It's all about the discipline.
Yeah,
it's a lot of work, man.
How do you kind of decide what, I mean, you must have so many, like, music and film and different kind of projects come at you. How do you decide what's something you want to pursue? Do you know immediately, or what kind of draws you to a project?
Yeah, I guess there's some kind of like a spinal reflex. Like, see if my spine is going to vibrate and say yes or no, you know? Something like that. Nothing really beyond that.
So it's instinctual, kind of?
It's very instinctual. And As you can tell, pretty much from our music, it's very instinctual. It's just like the epicenter of all those activities. In a way, it's all once. It's all one same crater of a similar activity. You know, I mean, I was never really interested in just playing music. Like, who cares about that? You know. I mean, there are people who care about that, yes. But I don't care about that. You know, like, I wanted to, like, you know, get a story like Johnny Cash, but, like, tell it like Iggy Pop, you know, like, that's what I wanted to do. Like, and you know, and have, you know, and have costumes and an orchestra behind me, helping me along, and you know, and hopefully perfume too, you know, and so on and so forth, and so that is just this kind of alchemic idea of it all. So when it gets like narrowed down to like, oh, it's just going to be a film, so it's almost kind of like, okay, it's going to be a film. You know, it's like it's kind of like a such a narrow idea compared to like what I actually usually do that. It's hardly ever more exciting.
How about, how about theater?
Same thing with the theater.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Have you done theater?
Yeah. But I just didn't pursue those things, you know, because the band kind of took off on time for me to just kind of
to
focus
sleep
on
in.
That. Yeah. I mean, there's other things, you know, I really loved DJing for like a certain amount of my life. I even went on tour as a DJ.
I got to hear you DJ in Chinatown. Someone took me, just said, I heard about this guy. It's great. And we went, and I liked it because I didn't know any of the songs.
Yeah. And that was my specialty.
And it was great.
Everyone go bananas and still not recognize even one single song.
that had an effect on me. I had so much fun. And I was like, I don't know.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Great. It was a lot of fun.
What kind of music? Just all over the place?
All over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Like tempos would drop. It was great.
Maybe you could illuminate on something I heard about. I don't think it was appropriately named what the person said it, but they said to ask about the Bulgarian bug juice that used to go around these parties. I guess there was some an alcohol of some sort that was.
Yeah.
Can you inform me of what this beverage was? Or?
No, you don't want to know.
Is it Demerol?
Bulgarian bug juice.
Yeah, I mean, it's something of dubious quality. I mean, I always brought my own bottles of wine. Okay. You know, that was my survival secret.
Still at the spin records.
Yeah, you know, I always came with a few bottles of Rioja.
Yeah, couldn't handle it. Or didn't want to. It's too much. What's in that stuff? I gotta know. It's like quaaludes to me now. It's some like mystical thing I can never do, and I'm curious.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the place is just has really dubious aesthetic, and yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they would have like medieval torture device in the middle of the dance floor there. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was just kind of, I was a DJ, the ambience coordinator.
Wait a minute.
That's not the same thing?
Yes, it is. Sonically.
Right.
Sonic ambience coordinator.
Now,
yes.
When you DJ, did you still use records? Or did you graduate to like the Serato kind of stuff? And the
Man, when I it's hard to imagine this, you know, because I play acoustic classical guitar and I, you know, but I was in 2000, the turn of the century time, I was like the most digital guy. I was like completely on top of it. I was DJing from like mini discs, like before anybody even knew what it was, like in 1998 probably already. Hmm. And I had my operations so figured out. I carried like a printer and a laptop, and like I could, during the one DJ gig, I would get another offer to the after-hour place, and immediately make a flyer and give some girl who was at that party like a bunch of these flyers, give her $100 and say, hey, can you please go and hit Max Fish and a couple other places and tell people that at 4:30 I will be there. You know,
that's pretty gangster, man.
Yeah, wow. It was. Yeah, I had like all good. Figured out. Yeah. So and then of course, when was Twitter when I needed it? You know. Then by the time I came around, I was already like, I already did this whole fucking thing. You know?
Right. Like I did this old school, man.
Yeah, and then I kind of actually lost my interest in DJing. Only special. Actually, tonight I'm DJing, but. Actually, I have to go.
Do you
there.
Need a printer?
I have to go. I get there soon.
Let's get you a printer.
No, this one is on. You know, this one is on digital media.
You just bring your own flash drive.
Yeah.
Between like the DJing and then just the story of Gogol getting together, I mean, I find it so fascinating that you guys met in New York. Mm-hmm. You know, from like all these parts of the world in New York. Like, how unique is your story? To New York, like could it have birthed anywhere else?
I don't think so.
Yeah,
I don't think so. There's a slight chance, maybe Toronto.
Okay,
because of their incredibly wide, you know, like whole mix,
right,
of foreigners,
sure,
and
sure.
Also the kind of a very friendly, accepting ethic that's going on just about anywhere there. So I think that's the only like place in the world I encountered that was similar like that, you know. Yeah, I mean, here I didn't really have to do much to gather the band of like characters I was looking for. You know, it's like either I would get an opportunity to meet one, or somebody would just come to the party quite soon, and. That was the entire idea of the band, is just kind of like have this like a gang that's where the kind of like a Jim Jarmusch movie, you know, where you don't really need the script all that much.
Right.
Once you get Tom Waits and John Lurie and Benigni together, it's like all these guys are in jail together, so now they're running away. That's like let's see what's gonna happen now.
Was it like your concept that brought all these people in, or was it like this gaggle of people that created the bordello?
I think that everyone who's in the band is an incredibly important part of it, and even some passing members also had pretty tremendous impact. I mean, of course, I'll always remain to, you know, kind of, I mean, I write all the songs.
Right.
You know, but... And people kind of gathered in the band on that notion that we will be playing the songs and stories that I tell, mm-hmm. you know. But I think that, you know, it's to a point of like, when I bring the songs to the band, like when I start making new record, you know, it's just kind of like, it's like this thing, but it becomes that thing,
right?
Only when everybody chimes in.
Sure.
And even if you would have one session player, say somebody will sit in to replace one of the members, it's already not that. Mm. It's already not vibe. Well, vibe is not there already.
Mm.
It needs to be like that vibe needs to be achieved. Again, you know, and because we kind of developed our own school of arrangement, you know, members of the band, they kind of have a very specific approach where they seem to know their way around it quite well.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a big collective psyche there, you know, and which is I really enjoy that oftentimes during sound check and put my guitar down, go on to take a seat and watch and be like, wow, that's some band, yo.
Thank you so much to Eugene Hutz for coming by. You can check out Gogo Bordello's new record, Seekers and Finders, out now. I also wanted to thank Ray, Eugene's publicist, for helping make this interview happen. I wanted to thank Stephen Grywalski and everyone at Pulse Music for letting us use their beautiful space. Want to thank everyone who's donated. Once again, if you want to donate, you can go to venmo.com/offtrack. Donate. Brad's name will come up. You can donate that way, or you can go to our website, goingoftrack.com.
I think I should say too, because it may be confusing. My name comes up. It's not my account. This is the Off Track account. It's
right.
It's just that the bank account is, it goes through me. So
yeah, no, that's
really
what I'm saying.
Confirmation.
But yeah, I think you get a note like Brad. Like I think
it comes up. Yeah, it says my name after you go to Off Track.
Right.
So
yeah,
just want to be clear.
Yes,
Jonah gets his cut.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. I joke about that a lot, but no, I think just logistically that's how it's set up.
I'm
saying that more so like people are like, who's this guy? Like, who's Brad?
Yeah, yeah, no. I want it to be clear that they're at the right place just because I want somebody to open an on-track account.
Right. Smart. Yeah, do not do that. And maybe we should do that.
Yeah, we should get all the...
Yeah.
Who is that? There was some company it was like 1-800 mattress or something back in the day when you did everything with 800 numbers. They bought like every 800 number that was like a misspelling of mattress as well, just so they no way that people would have to like dial twice.
This is something that I've wondered about, and maybe you'll be able to answer. This is a very weird question. You know how like when you buy a domain, like you're like, I want to buy breadworld.com. Yeah. Let's say how does that work? Because like, so what? Like, how does someone already owns that and they're selling it to you? Or like, why do you have to pay someone? Like, I don't.
Well, if it's unique, if you're the first one to come up with the idea, then it's just a registration fee because there's an organization. I think it's called ICANN, ICANN or something, and they essentially they're tasked with just sort of tracking these names. Yeah, it kind of doesn't make sense. Like, why should it cost anything, right?
Yeah, why should it cost anything?
Yeah, like, I'm not sure what the fee goes.
I'm like, oh, so you own every combination of letters? Like, why am I paying you?
Yeah, I should know the answer to this. And I kind of do. And it is that there is this kind of organization that's essentially, I guess theoretically what happens is that fee. Well, and the weird part is that like there's a lot of different companies that can sell you. Like, in other words, any company can sell you the same name.
Right, exactly. So, That's what I'm saying.
And there are different rates for it, too.
Right.
You know, you'll pay one rate at one place.
GoDaddy or whatever.
Yeah. And so, it all essentially goes back to this organization that tracks and keeps track of. And they also have the power to, like, release new ones, new .com names, like you have .com,
.ny or whatever.
So they like every so often they're gonna be like, okay, we're gonna do .nyc,
right?
And people
right.
can buy that. I don't totally understand all the mechanics of the internet, but it does seem like it's not a ton of money. You pay like what? Like you may pay like $12 or $14 a year for that domain,
right?
But yeah, it's essentially ones and zeros. It's kind of free, right? So it seems high.
Yeah.
But I think it would be, the speculation would be even worse if it wasn't fairly high, because otherwise, because you know what happened at one point back in like the aughts, there was some investment firm that went through and bought literally every single combination of two words or maybe even three words that was left that hadn't been registered. So they literally just made a random word generator that picked every combination of like one or two of two words together, and they bought them all just to speculate so they could then like sell.
Yeah, it's smart.
It's a lot of money. It's a pain in the ass.
Yes.
Because thankfully they didn't get three words and they would have got going off track.
Oh my God. Can you imagine? We'd be at goingofftrackpodcast.com. I guarantee you they were not buying up podcast URLs. Yeah, maybe as a bonus episode to our hardcore listeners, we could do Tech Talk with Brad, where I just ask questions that I've been wondering about.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So, thank you to everyone for donating, or anyone who's left us a review on iTunes, or anyone who has supported Going Off Track. Thanks, Eugene, for coming by. And yeah, we'll be back with another episode next week. Will we?
We will, man.
We will?
Definitely.
Okay.
Guaranteed.
Cool.
See you then.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.